In this week's programme, the decision by poet Michael Hartnett in 1974 to cease writing in English. He wrote only in Irish for 10 years after that. A new book from Mercia Press by Pat Walsh traces the background to and fallout from Hartnett's decision. A Farewell to English was published by Gallery Press in 1975 and dedicated to Brendan Kennelly. Michael Hartnett, who was born in Croom, County Limerick in 1941, died in Dublin in 1999. With me, the poet Nuala Ní Gonail and Michael Cronin, director of DCU's Centre of Translation and Textual Studies and author of Irish in the New Century. Pat Walsh says here, Nuala, that Hartnett's decision didn't create much of a ripple at the time. You know, it got an indifferent reception, except from Kieran Carson, who referred to it as derivative and echoes of Yeats, Kinsella, Kennelly, and so on. But did it, or Michael, did it? Is it your impression that it didn't create much of a stir?
I think it didn't create much of a stir at the time. In fact, one of the things that maybe surprised Hartnett at one level is that there wasn't going to be more of a stir, because he did express his apprehension beforehand. But I think to some extent what's more important is less, if you like, the immediate resonance of the act than the long-term resonance of the act. And I think to some extent what Hartnett was trying to articulate is something that John Montagu in The Rough Field try to articulate as well, and Thomas Kinsella talk about in terms of the divided mind, which was this perpetual dilemma for poets, Irish poets writing in English, with respect to their relationship to the Irish language, the language in which, if you like, the literary activity of the island had been conducted for most of its written life. So this radical choice that was made by Hartnett was something that I think in a longer term raised questions about the nature of the relationship between writing and language on the island.
Oh, indeed. I was only just trying to, first of all, trace, you know, the sort of impact at the time. Nuala, did I hear you say you were out of the country?
Yeah, I was out of the country. I was out of the country for all of the 70s, so I missed all of this. But I do distinctly remember Michael down in Newcastle West being bitterly hurt by some of the reviews of Farewell to England, Farewell to English. And one of them was Anthony Cronin writing in the Irish Times saying, you know that line from the Tale of Two Cities, nothing best suited him than he's leaving it. That's it. You know that, and that was a smart alecky line, but it was the last line, and Michael was devastated by it, and he was really, really hurt, and he went on about it not just once, but again and again.
It hurt at the time.
Yes,
but largely, as Michael was saying, it was a long term effect, a kind of a slow burn, the impact of the decision itself.
Oh, it was, yeah. And of course, he had been very much part of the Dublin literary scene, and then to head off to the wilds of you know, the Barna Gap, and you know, and West Limerick, which is very different from East Limerick. East Limerick is where the Normans were, and there's good land, but West Limerick is completely different. To land off on West Limerick, and then to, you know, to try to live on a self-sustaining farm was a huge and an absolutely enormous break for him.
What about his predecessors, Michael, in the matter? And to what extent was he influenced by them? I mean, Sean O'Rear, there had been John Reedy. Eugene Waters changed his name to Orno Thuidish. I mean, they were notable predecessors. Was he influenced by them to any degree?
I don't know if he was influenced by them. He was certainly aware of them. I think he was aware of the fact that, you know, Liam O'Flaherty, you know, had operated bilingually, the same with respect to Brendan Behan. You've mentioned Ono Thurisch, Micheál MacLiomór in his own particular way. So there had been, you know, a number of writers who had been, if you like, agitated or perplexed by this particular question. But what's interesting is that it's O'Tourishk and Hartnett that make that kind of, they take the radical step, they make the radical break. Hartnett talked about it and, you know, gave his reasons for the decision. I think that Oturysk, in fairness, gave a much deeper, much more elaborate explanation, and also, I think, foregrounded the deep suffering that was involved in making a decision like this, the kind of cost to him as a professional writer.
Yeah, and, I mean, he made the point that the Irish writer, Eugene Watt, feels pulled in two directions. You know, he says spiritually he belongs to the culture of Shakespeare and the culture of O'Rahilla, that both traditions, this would have been Othurish's view, had to be mastered.
But also, I think it would have been Michael Hartnett, because Michael Hartnett, was a great spouter of English poetry. I mean, he could start, you know, a thing of beauty is a, you know, a thing of beauty is a joy forever, and he could go on for 20 lines, which was more than the rest of us could, and he had a huge and very deep engagement with the English language. And he was very precise in his use of English. So there's this schizophrenia.
As interpreted by Pat Walsh, Michael, there's a whiff of linguistic determinism from both Waters and from Michael Hartnett, in the sense that if you change your language, you change your mental framework. I mean, that they both would have believed that.
I think that certainly kind of was something that underlay a lot of their thinking on the matter. And to some extent, I think what's important as well is to kind of put Hartnett's gesture in a wider context. I'm thinking of somebody like Ngugi, the Kenyan writer, who, you know, does a similar kind of, you know, a farewell to English. He kind of forsakes Gikuyu and initially, and then starts writing in English, and then he comes back to his native Kenyan language. So there is a kind of larger sort of kind of post-colonial dimension to this, the kind of relationship that people have to the native languages, and then the language of the conqueror or the colonizer. But I think in the case of Hartnett, what he was attempting to do was to foreground the nature and the extent of the loss of language shift, because to some extent what we must remember is that, you know, Shonda Fain used the word the great silence after the famine, is there was a great deal of silence around, you know, what the consequences were of being a translated people. I mean, Salman Rushdie talks about that anyone in a kind of post-colonial situation is a translated person, and I think that what Hartnett was kind of forcing us to do, and Oturysk as well, Hartnett in a very, very public way, was to reflect on what were the consequences. What happens, you know, when there is this massive shift from one language to another, when there's a move away from the language that, you know, that shapes the experience of people for many, many centuries.
I mean, at one point, Nuala, he talks about thinking, Michael Hartnett, that is, in two languages. To what extent do you think he did think in two languages?
I actually think he did. I mean, all art comes from two sides of the brain. I mean, all these brain scans now have shown that art and artists are more inclined to use both sides of the brain. I'd say with Michael, he used both sides of the brain, that one side of the brain was Irish and one side of the brain was English. And he was terribly aware of the huge loss to the country. He was terribly aware of the riches of bardic poetry, of a brother. For instance, here's a poem about a visit to Croom in 1745, where he puts himself into this time place. I had walked a long time in the mud to hear an avalanche of turf fall down, 14 miles in straw-roped overcoat, passing for Irish all along the road, now to hear a Gaelic court talk broken English to a broken king. It was a very long way to come for nothing. And he's aware of that. He's aware of the impoverishment of the language, that people who were so rich and witty and everything in Irish ended up speaking English because it was an excellent language to sell pigs in. And I mean, the language you sell pigs in is not the language of exuberant, funny, ribald, you know, crack.
That was a reductive view, though, wasn't it? I mean, you know, the language to sell pigs in was under... But Michael was being extremely reductive there, wasn't he, given the reaches of that very language? Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think it was. I mean, it's sure. obviously kind of a satirical moment. But I think yeah. what he was also trying to do yeah. in making that argument was that people constantly said, well, the problem with Irish is, you know, you couldn't sell pigs, and it was utterly useless as a language for the commercial, the modern world. So what he does is he kind of turns that argument back on English itself. But he's, yeah, I think he's doing that in a knowingly reductive way. I think to some extent the difficulty for Hartnett, and to some extent for Autorisk as well, is that there was a sense of the irrevocable. I mean, I used the word earlier of being a translated person, and I think it's interesting that towards the end of his life that that Michael began more and more to involve himself in the area of translation with the Obruder and the Hake's translations. But I think one of the reasons he was doing that is that he realised that it was not possible to go back to an earlier position where he would have been a kind of an Obruder, a kind of a public poet in his society, in the language. The sociolinguistic situation had changed so dramatically that, so to some extent, almost the metaphor, the notion of translation becomes a description of what it is when you're caught between these two languages and two worlds. But you have been translated. You have been translated into that dominant language, and then trying to find your way back becomes a very difficult and a very fraught process.
Yeah, that I can see that.
Oh, yes, he said about yeah. Obruder. He said he said it very, very clearly. He said, well, he had very good school Irish. I think he got, well, there were no A's in those days, but he got very high marks in Irish. And then, well, of course, he had to go for Obruder, who is about the hardest you can get. And he tackled Obruder, and he couldn't understand a single word of it.
yeah.
And but, yeah. but rather than dismay him, This was a.
What do you make of Moira Wakati's attitude to that? That he really wrote in Irish and translated Obruder in particular to energize his own writing in English. That's her take on that.
I don't believe that.
You don't? Hmm.
I don't believe that. I think it was to energize his own Irish, and it was to improve his own Irish. Hmm. To get,
yeah, what do you think of that, Michael?
To get to terms with the richness of Irish.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think one of the things about a translation process is that what it is, it's a kind of detailed exploration of the territory of language. And this is why I think the Obruder and the Hake's translations are so successful, is his level of engagement, you know, with the source's languages. So what he does is that he goes off almost like a traveller, you know, because one could argue that every translation is a form of travel writing. It's a description of your journey to and into another language. So what we get in Obruder and the Obruder translations, the Hake's translations, is a kind of a travel account of his journey into the Irish language. And of course, what makes this even more interesting, of course, is a journey into the past of the language, engaging with a particular kind of language, certainly in Obruder's case, as Nuala was pointing out, which is extraordinarily complex and dense and compact.
But Moira Wakati's claim, the reason he did that, made that journey, was to energise his own writing in English. Would you don't buy that? You don't?
No, I don't buy that, because I think that when you read Hartnett's writing in Irish, you know, it clearly has benefited from and been informed by, I think, particularly a certain sense of bardic density, you know, sense
and formality.
Of
formality.
Yes.
Oh yeah. Well, what kind of command of Irish did he have when he set out, Nuala?
Well, his spoken command of Irish, I thought it was very good, but he was a little bit embarrassed about it. But his written command of Irish was excellent, because he's written so many letters to me and everything else, and they were perfect. And he used to write in the Seanach Lo, the old script, which was so beautiful, you know, and it was so beautiful. And I mean, he's the only person I knew, you know, of our generation.
That he'd wrote in it, that's true. I mean, I was struck by Pat Walt saying that he didn't distinguish between Irish and English at all until he went to school.
Yeah,
that doesn't surprise you.
No, that doesn't surprise me, because that was his granny. That was out in...
All four grandparents had spoken Irish.
They had. And that was when he was sent out, basically, from Newcastle West to his aunt, who was an all-Irish speaker. And later on, when he returns to English, like, for instance, in one of the Inchicore haikus, my English dam bursts, and out stroll all my bastard, Irish shakes its head. Well, his English is very different from his Irish. You know, his Irish is much richer than his English.
So, until what decade would you have found in West Limerick that kind of fluency in Irish or a speaking of Irish in the way that his grandparents spoke? Would it have lasted into the 20s, 30s and later?
I'd say it would last into the 1930s. My 30s. Grandfather was from West Limerick and he was an Irish speaker. So late 1920s?
Yeah, they tried to start a Gaeltacht there in...
In West Limerick?
Yeah, in West Limerick. Yeah, they did, yeah. And there were, you know... Well, I don't know what stopped it in the end, but there was a lot of grassroots interest in the language.
One thing I'd like to say, just in terms of, I think, Hartnett's achievement in English and Irish, I think they're two different orders of achievement. I think to some extent, and this is always a problem, I think, when we have poets who do write in both languages, is there's, you know, sometimes these kind of invidious comparisons are made, you know, whether the English is better than the Irish or vice versa. And it seems to me that these are two different voices. They're two different practices. I mean, as Nuala was saying earlier, there's a kind of formality that's there in Hartnett's writing in English that's not there in Irish, which is not there in English. Mm. But what there is there in English, I think, is a kind of tough-mindedness, a kind of the way in which he's able to use simplicity or the prosaic in an extraordinarily kind of powerful way. He can use simple words like house and field and milk in a way that I think no other poet in the late 20th century can in English, because it would sound kind of irretrievably weak. But he invests these with a kind of an intensity that makes his writing in English very distinct.
What do you make of that, Nuala, that precise point?
I would agree, because let's say, let me just say a piece about her, his grandmother. Ignorant in the sense she ate monotonous food and thought the world was flat, and pagan in the sense she knew the things that moved at night were neither dogs nor cats, but pukas or dark-faced men. Now, there's, you know, apart from monotonous, there's no three-syllable word or four-syllable word in that. It's very simple. Mm. But it is very powerful.
Yes, it is. In fact, I just happened to read that particular poem early this morning before we came. Did you, Michael, have something you wanted to read to us? Either to illustrate that point or not, or anything at all.
It's an extraordinary kind of convergence here, because that was precisely the poem that I wanted to read.
So we've all been inspired.
All converged.
This
morning, yeah. So perhaps I might read the poem through to its conclusion, because I think the last line is one of the most beautiful lines in late 20th century Irish writing in English. Death of an Irish woman. Ignorant in the sense she ate monotonous food and thought the world was flat, and pagan in the sense she knew the things that moved at night were neither dogs nor cats, but pulchas and dark-faced men. She nevertheless had fierce pride. But sentenced in the end to eat thin, diminishing porridge in a stone-cold kitchen, she clenched her brittle hands around a world she could not understand. I loved her from the day she died. She was a summer dance at the crossroads. She was a card game where a nose was broken. She was a song that nobody sings. She was a house ransacked by soldiers. She was a language seldom spoken. She was a child's purse full of useless things.
That child's purse useless things is extraordinary.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah,
it's almost as if there's 300 years of Irish history are condensed into that. Excellent. And that beautiful kind of repetition there at the end, where you know, he's both restating the heart but also kind of recapitulating.
And he's also bringing it from Irish, you know, you know, there's lots of phrases in Irish like that. So he's playing on that as well.
What was the title of that poem again?
Death of an Irish Woman.
Death of an Irish Woman. And translating your own work, Nuala, what did you think of his approach to your own
stuff? Well, I was so happy that anyone would translate them. We sat, it was very ad hoc. We sat in Groga's pub and I said, oh, do that one. I don't like that one. Don't do that one. Do that one. So it was all very ad hoc. But he brought to the it a level of English that I could never have done it myself. You know,
a clarity, an
intensity that I could never have done myself.
His preference for O'Brother over O'Rahilla, he said, you know, O'Rahilla had a lyricism that O'Brother didn't have, and then the point is made here, O'Rahilla lacks one attribute O'Brother had in Hartnett's view, and that was a certain majesty. What's he talking about here?
I think this, to some extent, corresponded to an element in Hartnett's work, which I think is very, very important to remember. He talks at one point when he's making a case for, you know, why John Jordan should pay for him to study in UCD, and he talks about how he was invulnerable under the cloak of learning. I think the thing to remember about Hartnett is that he was extremely erudite. He was a scholaider. He was a very learned poet, read widely, you know, in all kinds of literatures. In fact, was ticked off by the Irish Press's radio correspondent because she felt, what were all these foreign poets like Mayakovsky and Pasternak doing on his program? You know, why do we have sort of good, you know, Paddy the Plain Pint, you know, reading his poems? So, so he had that kind of very wide-ranging erudition. I think what drew him to somebody like O'Brother was that wonderful mixture of someone who was very conscious of his audience, was very conscious of wanting to speak to people, but not somebody who speaking to people does not mean speaking down to people. That O'Brother was somebody who, because he respected the people that he talked to, addressed them with the full kind of majesty and power of his erudition, his knowledge of the tradition, and his mastery of the language.
And his venom.
Absolutely, which is, you know, a crucial part of the intellect.
And as you were saying earlier, Hartnett would have longed for the kind of status that O'Brother had in the 17th century, and that was...
Wouldn't we all?
it's only just different terms. It has changed, and yet you're the ones who'll be remembered. You know, to appropriate Kavanagh in 100 years or more.
Well, with Kindle and all of this,
you know,
stuff.
It's
anyway.
Poets they'll be talking about. You know, not the businessman and perhaps some politicians and Michael.
Well, I think that the poets, we talk about certain people in Irish life being untouchables in the worst sense of the word, but I think that poets are untouchables.
No, but I mean, he quotes Fred Johnson here saying that Hartnett was marginalised, but it is odd, isn't it, that poets are rarely seen in their time, Nuala, central to a culture, and yet you're the ones who are remembered.
Yeah, but, you know, you accept being marginalised. I mean, we don't offer things that are finite. We don't offer things that are easily converted into mercantile qualities. Mm. We don't. And so, you know, that's the way.
But
it is.
But it's odd, though, that turnaround, isn't it? You know, that 100 years or several hundred years later.
Yeah, but what use is that to you when you're dead?
But I think to some extent, I mean, this is one of the reasons why, when we think about, you know, how we want to kind of shape the future of education, broadcasting, all kinds of things, I think we should be looking to the poets, because what poetry demonstrates is that you never know what the future will look like. And that's why you've got to be as open and as responsive in the widest possible way to the present, because then you create resources for the future. The difficulty is when you believe that poetry or education or anything else has got to do a very specific thing, because that specific thing, which might seem relevant now, could be completely irrelevant in 100 years' time.
So. How difficult was it to return to English for him after a decade? It can't have been easy.
Yeah, well, he says that line about his English bastards blow out. I think it was because he was back in the Dublin literary set. He was cut off from West Limerick. He was cut off also from, you know, his roots in West Limerick, which were mainly Irish. He was cut off from the very, very hard work that he had done at that stage. I mean, his O'Rahilly and O'Brother were actually finished at that stage, and so was his Pádraig an Haicéid. And also, he was drinking too much.
Well, in the 20th century, I mean, we tend to think of artistic self-destruction as as a peculiarly 50s phenomenon. But as you say, he was self-destructing much later than that.
Yeah, I've thought of that so often because I met him the day of the... we were in the green room. There was this big hoo-ha and we were all supposed to be sending books, selling books. And I was just disgusted by the whole blah of the thing. I mean, I just thought, this is ridiculous. And I was sort of sulking in the green room. And Michael was sulking in the green room too. And I said to him, you know, he was drunk. And I said to him, Michael, you're drinking too much. And he says, Nuala, it doesn't matter, my work is over. And you know, ever since then, I'm kicking myself. Every day of the week, I kick myself that I didn't have the wit to say to him, Michael, you're more than your work.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
It didn't dawn on me because I was so gobsmacked.
Yes.
But it was true, it was part of the atmosphere or something that surrounded, you know, Michael in the last years of his life. I remember being at the launch of Inchicore Haiku and there was drinks afterwards in a pub called the Richmond, and it really felt like a wake. And initially, I remember thinking, is it to do with the fact of, you know, breaking out again in English? Is this a sense of a kind of regret or sorrow? But it was something much larger. It was the sense that there he was, if you like, center stage, but vanishing, you know, vanishing to a vanishing point in that kind of very self-destructive way, in a way that was almost unstoppable.
The poet Maudy kind of scenario, which was more, he was probably the last of them. I mean, I haven't met one since.
We've been discussing A Rebel Act, Michael Hartnett's Farewell to English by Pat Walsh, published by the Mercia Press. My thanks to Nuala Ní Chónaill and Michael Cronin. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie and on the RTE player. Till next week, bye-bye.